Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the May 2015 episode of The Three Horsemen. Tonight we have a very special guest horseman, or in this case, a horsewoman, Miss Irene Gallo of Tor Books, Tor.com, and many, many other hats. Good evening, Irene.
Hello, good evening.
Thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And as always, I am joined by my two co-hosts, Mr. Jeff Patterson.
Hey, Jeff Patterson here. I blog at JeffPatterson11 on Twitter. I am in the recent mind meld by Paul Reamer on SF Signal, and I now officially do little columns for the Science Fiction Book Club. So,
excellent.
And my other co-host, Mr. John Stevens.
Yes, that would be me. Is it me? So I am a writer, and I write reviews and occasional columns for SF Signal. I have a blog that is woefully underloved at the moment. I'm most often on Twitter as Erudite Ogre, and I am also writing things hither and thither.
All right, and the reason we wanted to get Irene on tonight was that one of the things I wanted to look at this year was the process of making books. So at some point we hope to have a small press publisher on. If we can wrangle an editor, we'll get an editor on. And we'll even get some authors on. But I've always loved cover art. I mean, you're not supposed to judge a book by the cover, but in the 1960s, my eye was caught by Jack Gaughan's weirdly bug-like artwork for Doc Smith's Lensman series. And there will be a link in the show notes which shows you one of those covers. And then my next love, a few years later, was in the 1970s. Ballantine Books did a series edited by Lynn Carter, the Ballantine Adult Fantasy series. And although it did not have a uniform look that people like Irene later brought to publishers, it certainly showcased a lot of great art by Pauline Bynes and Bob Pepper and other people that just drew you towards those books. And the third great renaissance in art for me was a guy named Rick Sternbach, who did artwork for Analog and things like Ballantine Books before he became snatched up by Star Trek and made all his money there. But things like Larry Niven's Known Space, where they tied the covers together with a frame and a similar font and cover art that all spread across an entire series, just attracted me. What always bugged me, though, and I know, Irene, this is probably something you've noticed over the years, is when a publisher doesn't credit an artist.
Yes, yeah. We try very hard not to do that.
We try to make sure
that we credit everybody, for sure.
You do an excellent job of that. So, you know, there's been many times I've found something I've loved, and it's like, well, who does that? And I'm like, no credit. So, you've been with Tor as, I think, as long as I've known you online. This is actually the first time we've ever talked verbally.
Since 93. So okay. It's been a while. It's 93 I came to Tor, and by 94 I was the art director.
Wow. So did you start out with a background in art, I assume?
I did. I went to Cooper Union. I liked art in high school and did some summer programs and stuff, and I went to art school, not really thinking about what that would mean in my life. I just wanted to go to art school and really kind of gravitated towards graphic design. I always liked books, worked in the library in college, and so when I came out, I wound up at a sort of a small production company for books that, and our main client was Tor. And so after probably like somewhere between 6 and 8 months of working there, Tor just needed some help, and they hired me directly. So that's how I came into Tor. I lucked into it pretty quickly, I have to say.
And were you always at that point at the art end, or did you wear many hats even then?
At that point, I was pretty much the art end only. I was the assistant to the art director, so it was, you know, mostly doing some filing and running up and down stairs and things like that. And it was the very end of traditional mechanicals. But she quickly sort of faded out. She was sort of changing her life, and I was able to sort of slowly evolve into the job. I really didn't take on all these different hats until tour.com started. It launched in 2008, but we were working on it about a year and a half before that. So that's when my job sort of evolved into these two very separate jobs.
And that was, as I recall, July 20th, 2008.
It was Moon Landing Day.
Yes.
Which we enjoy very much.
Now, I mean, this is kind of interesting, the process of from going to mechanicals to electronic and websites and ebooks and stuff. I mean, for a while there, it seemed like possibly art would become secondary, but that's not true.
Not at all. Not at all. And in fact, I think as ebooks have been on the rise, we've increased our commissioning. I mean, still every book needs a jacket. It's still it was always a piece of advertising. I like to make it as artful as possible, of course. Mm-hmm. But in the end, it's a piece of advertising, and that's no less true on Amazon and on Nook and every place else. But not only that, I mean, with blogs and things, you know, it's the covers have become even more of a means to talk about books. And so we, you know, we'll do multiple versions sometimes. When iBooks launched, we did a Ender's Game jacket just for ebooks. I'm still calling them jackets. They're just covers. And, you know, so we would do these bundles, and so we get a cover. We did, we took the entire Malazan series and we put it into one ebook, and so we commissioned a new cover for that. So it's actually done nothing but increase possibilities for commissioning new artwork. And that's been a lot of fun.
Yes, I bought that massive single volume.
Yes, oh, good, excellent.
And also that wonderful single file that you guys did last year for the Hugos of Wheel of Time.
Yes, yeah, so... And then the website itself has just opened up so many opportunities for artwork. The short fiction, we have original artwork for every piece of original short fiction that we do. And that really alone has just sort of doubled my commissioning. So it's been really fun.
Now, do you have a stable of artists that you go to, or?
Absolutely. Know? But, you know, it's always evolving. So there's the people that, you know, I went to them because they were really good and I liked them. And as the years go by, they're no less good and I still really like them. And you develop relationships with them and they sort of get established. They sort of start to become sort of signifiers for a kind of science fiction or fantasy. And that helps, too. So there's definitely my sort of tried and true guys that I really love. But any art director is always like really excited about finding the new artist too. So I just got back from Spectrum. Spectrum has been an art annual for the past 21 years, but the last 4 years they've had a convention and it's just artists from all over the country, from out, you know, outside of the United States coming in. And really I probably looked at 75 portfolios over the course of 3 days and, so it's, yeah, you're always trying to find, like, the new voice and, you know, the new cool kid. So keeps things fresh and fun. And
I actually was going to ask you about Spectrum because that's been something I've been buying for, what were we up to, like?
22 years.
20, yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty much shadowed my career at Tor. So I've been at Tor for about 22 years, and they're creating the 22nd volume now.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jeff, do you want to...
Well, yeah, were you talking about the stable of authors and the, you know, doing all the short fiction and the website and stuff like that, you were part of the, Ask the Experts that they had in Imagine FX about getting into book illustration a couple months ago. And in it, you did this. There was this one page that showed the process of Cynthia Shepherd's cover for Karen Memory,
right?
And it had some notes from you. And what fascinated me about it was, number one, I love looking at process work, and number two, the fact that it was such a short turnaround that you had to do. And I'm kind of curious, A, how rough is a short turnaround? And B, given the amount of hats that you're wearing, how many of them do you have in the air at once?
Well, you try not to have too many. And one of the reasons the tour books versus tour.com thing works for me is that the schedules are very different. You know, publishing is sort of infamously glacial. It works in seasons. You know, you're talking about meetings that are happening 3 or 4 months later, and those are for books that are publishing 9 to 12 months later. So, you know, you can kind of, if something doesn't get done in the next 10 minutes, it can be done tomorrow morning, you know, usually. So I can kind of juggle that with tour.com, which is usually, oh my God, something just happened. How do we cover this right now? Or, you know, hey, this opportunity just arose. How do we really take advantage of it? So it actually becomes easy. It's what makes it possible for me to juggle these two things. I can kind of put one on hold and jump to the other back and forth. Plus, I just have a tremendous staff on both sides. So that is the real trick of it. But so turnarounds, though, you know, you try not to, in books, you try not to have turnarounds like that. And this happened because I hired a very good artist that I won't mention, but they're excellent, one of my favorites, and it just, the tone just wasn't working, and I really think it was sort of a failure of the art director. I think I kind of picked the wrong person for the project, and so Cynthia Shepherd was somebody that I wanted to work with for a while and never had, and it was tough. I vacillated on it for a little bit and was just wasting more time. But I really thought she can do it. But given the fact that it had already sort of gone awry, I was a little bit worried, a little bit gun shy. But finally, I was just like, you know, I need to. A decision is better than no decision at this point. So I called her up. Never worked with her before. I met her a bunch of times. But just said, you know, I hate to do this, but I don't even have much information on the book, and here it is. And I had promised her more information, and before I could even get it to her, she had done these three fabulous sketches, and we had 10 days pretty much to put it all together. And as I say, I gave her the initial brief and said, oh, I'll get you some more stuff. And before I could even do that, I got these three great sketches. And as soon as I saw those, I just knew the whole project was going to be a breeze at that point. And it was a real relief. And I think those sketches are in that article.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, so it was cool. Like, any one of them would have been great. And I mean, I really like the one we went for. But as I say, at that point, it was just a pleasure. And
what struck me about that cover in particular is we don't get the ratio of covers these days that really give you an iconic image of the character. It isn't as high as it used to be. I mean, yeah, there used to be a lot of Starscapes and stuff like that, but occasionally when you had a book that was about a given character, you normally got a view of the character. And this was, I mean, that is just such a... The only thing I can compare it to is back when the Grimjack comic was coming out, that first issue of Grimjack, which was just him sitting there with a cigarette, a gun, and a sword. It was like, wow, there's your character right there.
Well, I do think there's, you know, people always ask about trends, too. And I think right now we're sort of in a situation where I think back in the 80s and 90s, people would do this like heavily rendered realistic painting of characters a lot. And that was the style then. And everybody sort of enjoyed that. And I think we sort of evolved into almost two extremes where people either want the very photographic cover where you hire models, a photographer, get costumes and do the whole bit, or they want something much more painterly. And Cynthia's really on that sort of like, you know, John Sargent-y painterly, you know, it's not trying to, you know, it's almost that Uncanny Valley idea. Like, she's not trying to reproduce, you know, an illusion of a real person standing there. She's creating a painting. And I think people do respond to that. They still sort of respond to that fairly well. And I think there's a couple of other artists like Keikai Kotake and Richard Anderson and people like that, that have got this really nice, you know, it's almost a fine art aesthetic, and they bring it to like real high adventure, action, science fiction, fantasy. And I think it's personally something that I really enjoy. So I'm glad it resonated with people so well. The author was really happy. And whenever the author's happy, you know, you're sort of 10 times as happy as you would have been. So
do you find yourself in situations where you have to work, where you're working with the development of something that's fairly representational, like that cover, But at the same time, you got to deal with something that's a bit more stylistic or maybe abstract for another title. And if so, do they access different parts of your head?
Sure. You know, each story sort of demands its own thing. And so definitely. And one of the things I've loved about the short fiction on Tor.com is that it's just exploded the breadth of artists I can use. Since they're not, you know, we don't sell, I mean, we do sell the stories. You can go on Amazon for $1, you can download it, you know, or Barnes & Noble or anywhere else for ease of reading. But we don't expect to sell many of them because we are giving them away for free on the site. And so they don't have sort of the burdens of like, do they, you know, does sales like them? Does marketing like them? Is the bookstore going to like put them face out or not? You know, so, and also, and just short fiction is just so intrinsically different than a novel. Like, you know, it is a bit more, just sort of a bit more ephemeral and, you know, just sort of accesses sort of a different kind of storytelling. And so I don't think I really thought that through before we started the site, like how different the illustration could be. And so I really do love being, you know, being able to go back and forth between these two different things. And even as you say, within novels, there's, you know, there's places where you go much more sort of just symbolic or, you know, it's every book is its own world. So you try to treat them as such. I enjoy it all. You know, I enjoy just straight on big action adventure artwork. And I enjoy like, you know, some more abstract, just design, really great typography. And really the fun of the job is honestly liking all of these options.
Yeah. Go ahead, John.
No, I think I said,
Oh, okay.
I was going to say, do you ever work across publishers?
You mean with other publishers? Not technically, not for Tor.com. I mean, not for the artwork, but within Tor.com. I mean, as a, you know, beyond commissioning artwork for Tor.com, I'm the associate publisher for that. And so I as a mission, we work with other publishers. We try to be, you know, publisher neutral. So we are in contact with other publishers just to sort of help promote their books, get review copies and the whole bit, but not within my art job, other than, you know, I'm friends with and know some of the other art directors. Lauren Penapinto at Orbit Books is a good friend of mine, and we'll be like, hey, see any new good artists lately? Or, hey, I was needed somebody that kind of was like this, and, you know, so we'll trade notes that way and send good people. As I say, we just got back from Spectrum, and I got a list of some of my favorite portfolios, and I just like sent an email blast to 5 or 6 people that I know that might be interested in them, and just said, hey, these are some good people I saw. Maybe you can use them.
I just remember it was Swanland, I think, when you guys redid the Black Company series.
Sure. Yeah,
and then,
he's great.
Then Nightshade used him for another Cook series. It was like, look at that.
Yeah, and that makes sense. And we do that too. You know, if we're publishing an author that's been published elsewhere, I'll always go look, and, you know, maybe, you know, it always informs the decision whether it's whether it says, you know, whether we want to keep in that same vein or we want to purposely go, you know, separate from that. You know, we just sort of do that research as well. And
are there artists that you associate with specific authors? I mean, I'm thinking Daryl K. Sweet for many years was with Robert Jordan.
Sure.
But Swanland with Cook, or who was the artist that did Palancar and...
I was going to say Palancar and Charles Dillent. Yep.
Yes, yes.
We do, you know, and certainly for series, you know, if everything goes right, you just want to keep that artist with that series. And of course, inevitably, like I'll put an artist on one series and then a year later on another, and then 2 years later, all the series are coming together into one season, and then you go, oh my God, what am I going to do? But definitely, and so, you know, you try to be cognizant of that and try to keep them, you know, going on very different kinds of things. But so, yeah, if all's going well, you want to keep the same artist on that series. Sometimes you want to keep, like with the Dillent, you know, they were all sort of a role, but not necessarily one after another. But still, like, it was a good pairing between the two of them. And so we kept that going for quite a while. So, yeah, you try to do that if you can.
Okay. Jeff, more? Or?
Well, yeah, it's funny you say that because I was actually, because of the last few columns that I had to write over the course of the last week or so. I've actually been paying attention to a lot of the cover art that's been involved, and I was looking at like the Jean-Francois Poterin covers that Spectre used in the 80s for several different books that just literally screamed 80s aesthetic. You look at them now, mm-hmm. and you're just waiting for a guy with a handheld keyboard to come out and start dancing at the front of the stage. You know, compared to guys like Van Dongen and Carol Full, who did more situational, almost like they were trying to do movie posters or situational, like storyboard type things, tried to bring a definite cinematic. And even then, even though they're fairly timeless artists, you look at the book and you go, oh, that's from the 70s. And, sure. you know, and it's especially true of the 80s, not so much the 90s. But I'm actually curious, since you've been, you know, on the front lines of this for so long, do you think there's going to be, when this decade is over and done, which can't come soon enough for me, do you think there'll be an aesthetic that it will be known for? Do you think there will be last decade we had a lot of women with swords facing away from us, you know, and
right, yeah,
kind of curious.
Sure, definitely. You know, as you're saying that, I was just thinking, like, I have now been at Tor long enough where I could see the books that I worked on that, you know, in those first 5 years and go, oh my god, it's so like early 90s.
Really? Can you give me an example?
Oh, sure. I can't. It'd be hard to. I will send links and things, but I don't want to like put them down for that. It's they were of their era, and that's appropriate over the time. And you're always going to have some that are just came out better, or some that will, like, despite the fact that they sort of are within the aesthetic of their era, are still, as I say, timeless and still sort of resonate. But I think, as I say, I think this will be there being very photographic and very, highly cropped bits and pieces of people holding swords and things. And, but hopefully, you know, I do think though, with the internet and things like this, I mean, I think the sort of spheres of influence are getting sort of shorter in a way. I think, you know, back when, you know, Waylon was rightfully just, you know, considered the best there is, and everybody wanted, they either wanted Waylon or somebody that looked like Waylon. And I think that lasted for a very long time. And,
we went through a Martinari phase as well. So.
Yeah, you know, but I think these phases go much more quickly now because there's just so much communication and people could talk about it. And I think things move more quickly and are more open to other styles. And I think that's a good thing, you know, as much as I like all of the above, you know, as I say, I do sort of love all of it. I like that we don't have a decade and a half of one influence anymore. And I think that's all for the good.
There's no house look like,
Daw
always had, you know, desaturated painted backgrounds and one or two foreground characters. That was their motif for,
right.
Or Ace doubles too.
Yeah.
Had a really distinctive aesthetic too. Kind of insane sometimes, but
well, say we try to like make every book, you know, do right by each one individually, and they're not going to be shelved together, you know, once they're in the bookstores or on somebody's bookshelf, it's not like you can have all the Tor books in one place, so they should really be responsible to themselves more than to a corporate look, I think.
Do you find yourself, when you got a book that you know is the first book in a series and you got the cover that nails it, are you thinking ahead about the covers after that?
You do, you know, and usually.
Well, here's a good example. How tightly did you work on the Sin Season Town that right now, Cien Liu, his trilogy? Oh,
yeah, I mean, those were great. And, Stefan just really, I mean, I love his work to begin with, and I think he really did a particularly good job on that first one, and it's exactly the kind of story I think that he likes a lot, and so it just became a pleasure to see. And he's also somebody who likes to read the manuscripts, and it's really, you know, an art director's job is largely a casting director's job. You know, you just try to match up the right tone and feel. You try to match up the right artist to the book. And that's, you know, 75% of the job is done right there. And so Stefan was the right guy for that series. And it was just a pleasure to watch him just sort of do all three of them, you know, pretty quickly. And so, you know, that worked out really well. I'm sorry, I forgot the question too. I thought I had another example in my mind in it.
Of a, you know, series.
Oh, thinking about the new series, yeah. And you know, it's funny. I just got sketches in for Dinosaur Knights, which is going to be the sequel to Dinosaur Lords, and that one, like, we put it up online and everybody went nuts over it, and that was a lot of fun. So once you get the first one right, when you really get it right, like it's just a pleasure to see those titles come up in the schedule again. You're like, oh, it's gonna be fun. Like, it's gonna be easy because you know who's going to do it. You kind of know the tone of it, and you can just sort of enjoy the process of it. So.
On the technical end of things, when you get a cover for a ebook, or even if it's going to be a regular book, how big of a file are we talking here?
It's 350 DPI, you know, at least the like 6x9, which is the book cover size. We really like to get them bigger, so if we need to zoom in on anything. And I'm not very good about the technical things, and I know that some people give me a file and it prints perfectly fine at, you know, 2 megs, and somebody else has a 50 meg file, and so I don't know what the differences are, but I do know that it needs to be 150 and or 350 and at least print size. So
now you mentioned the Dinosaur Knight covers that I guess you had a reveal. Do you find working with the community? I mean, Torque.com is a big community at this point, an amazingly big community, and with branches everywhere. I mean, does the interaction with the fans, you know, is it too much noise or is it still good, or, you know?
Oh, it's great. It's really fun. I mean, what's great too is the fans are now, you know, they've always had an opinion about covers, as well they should. And but they're now, you know, getting to learn the artist names and talking about them and wanting to blog about them themselves. And I think that's great. They're really, you know, the artists are, I think, more part of the process than they've ever been. And I think the fans are more part of the process than they've ever been. And I think that's all great. All that awareness is great. And it's fun, you know, it's fun to put it up and see what people think. And it's very rewarding, rather than waiting the 12 months for the book to come out and, you know, then waiting for a convention to hear how people talk about things. You know, now we get a very immediate gratification, or not, but either way, it's always a fun roller coaster.
Mr. Stevens. I know.
You guys have much better questions than.
Yeah, I don't want to leave you out.
because I think of the three of us, I'm the one who's sort of least into the art aspect of the fiction. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And it's funny. I was thinking about questions. I actually went and read your AMA from a couple of years ago, and to see what people had asked you before. And I guess the thing the two things that I always wonder about are, I don't know how to articulate it. I mean, I'm thinking from the perspective of a writer, of an author, and what kind of impact do you think the art really has on people not just buying the book, but on their expectations for what's inside the book?
Sure. Go ahead.
No, I mean, just because you had said earlier that, you know, sometimes the artists don't, you know, get a lot of advance, you know, knowledge of what's in the book, other than maybe just enough to sort of go on.
Right.
But I mean, when I look at some of the art for recent books, it's interesting to me what actually draws me into the book.
Sure.
Because I usually come to a book already knowing a lot about the book, and then I get to the cover and I try to think how that articulates what I know, and then later I try to think how did that articulate with what I've what I've seen.
Sure.
And do you think about those things a lot when you're looking at art and working with artists?
Well, you always think of the cover as being the introduction to the book. Now, as you say, like, you know, most people will have read something about it, maybe a review, or maybe friends talked about it. They know the author already. You know, there's all these things that come into play. But in a sense, the cover is still introducing the book to a lot of people, and it does sort of set the tone, you know, very quickly in split second, out of the corner of somebody's eye. You know, my boss Tom Daugherty has often said it's one of the hardest jobs in publishing. Because somebody out of the corner of their eye in a split second can have an opinion about it. And, you know, to have an opinion about the book, you have to read it. And to have an opinion about marketing and publicity, you have to know what those plans are and what those mean. And yet, you know, in any meeting at any moment, somebody can be like, I don't like it, or it's too yellow. But but generally people are very good, you know, and I find, you know, it's easy to be like, oh, marketing didn't get it or whatever. But I've found that 9 times out of 10 when they have a comment, you know, they're pretty spot on, and they know their clients are working with Barnes & Noble and people like that, and you know, they're experienced and good at that. But you were talking about the reader and their introduction to the book as the cover, and it has to influence people. It just does. And I know, even as an art director, I know that I won't assume a book is good because I like the cover. But on the other hand, I have a really hard time when people tell me it's a really good book and that I'd like it and I don't like the cover. I have a really hard time sort of believing that. Yeah. Although I have to say, and this is terrible, and people, Lou Anders especially, like, goes nuts when I say this, but I'm not precious about books. And if I don't like a cover, I take it off.
I'm a bookseller and a former librarian, so that's like,
No, I'll take them off. I even have, like, I was reading one really thick book, and it kind of was starting to split in half, and I'm like, you know what, if I just, like, cut this book in half, it'll fit on the subway much better. So I am not a precious person. I like them to be used, and actually, there's nothing I like better than when I really love a book. There's nothing I like better than having it at the end and having it just be dog-eared and smudged and, you know, having lived with me in my backpack for, you know, however long. So I actually sort of enjoy that part of the process.
This could be the most controversial thing
ever. yeah, I'm still stunned. What?
Well, it's funny that you bring that up about the reader representation, because I'm thinking of the opposite effect. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a book with a Tom Kidd cover that I haven't bought, and so few of them actually live up to the Tom Kidd cover.
That's funny, yeah.
It gives you such this utterly immersive, you know, vistas that we never quite get the eyeball kick over the course of the book to really to really match it.
Yeah, I think he's phenomenal. He's great.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking about that when you mentioned the Three Body Problem books earlier. And I tend to like the painterly covers you were talking about at the beginning.
Right.
But those covers really, for some reason, draw me in. And part of it is the way the words are put on top of the artwork, which I kind of want to talk about, too. I mean, I don't know how that works in an art department, but it's interesting to me to see how the words that sort of have to go on the front cover
do not
articulate with the art that's presented there. You know what I mean?
Sure, absolutely. And that's one of our senior designers, Jamie Stafford Hill, who's actually also the designer for Tor.com. He came up with the entire, you know, sort of layout of the website. Mm-hmm. And he's phenomenal, and he's very, very thoughtful designer. And, you know, when each one came out, you know, he's always comparing the second one to the first one, and then the third one to the second one and the first one, and, you know, making sure the spines all sort of, you know, have a flow to them. And we don't have most book publishing art departments won't have any staff illustrators. They're all freelance. Gaming companies, you know, like Wizards of the Coast or something, might have, or at least they used to, I don't know if they still do, might have staff artists, but any publishing company won't. But we do have staff designers, and I've got a couple people in house that are just fantastic. And I'll give them the artwork. I over the years, as I've come more into management, I've sort of stuck with working with the artists and then not doing so much of the design anymore, and really handing all of that off to my guys. The more meetings I go to, the better they get at what they're doing, and so that's what works out all right. And he came up with a few options. We just tape them to a wall, talk about them, sort of stand back, take a look, and just sort of go from there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's interesting. Yeah, it's just the thing that always strikes me when looking at a book cover is that I always read like the words first, because the book is what's important to me, like what's in the
sure.
book, and then
absolutely.
Go to the artwork. And it's interesting how that can then actually further influence my decision. I hadn't heard much about the Three Body Problem books until some people started talking about it on Twitter. But then when I saw the covers, I thought, wow, that's... For some reason, that really, I thought, really pulled me in.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's the way that the word that the type and the words are actually integrated with the artwork. They actually work with the artwork. And to use a counterexample, I was looking at the cover to Kim Stanley Robinson's new book, Aurora, and like, I don't like that cover at all, because it's just his name,
right?
And then the title in small letters, and then like stars in the background in a space station.
It's I
mean, there's not an integration that I see with the three, especially the Dark Force. I think that the Dark Force is actually a better cover than Three Body Problem, even though there's not a huge amount of, they're not dissimilar art styles. Mm-hmm. Something about the mixture of color and where the type is set and how the words are both foregrounded, but somehow almost part of the artwork.
Yeah.
Seems to really be effective at saying, here's a book that'll be interesting because what you see right here is also very interesting, and not just, just the artwork or just whatever, but the elements all work together.
Well, thanks. I will pass on the compliment to the designer, because, as I say, sure. He is very, very thoughtful and very good at what he does. And they're great sort of big, big concept, sense of wonder sort of covers. And
yeah,
there's definitely, you get into these for Kim Stanley Robinson, you get into sort of an idea sometimes, or, the sort of Stephen King effect, where it's like you don't need anything but his name on it. So you wind up with 8-foot letters, Stephen King. And,
yep.
So that could sometimes come into play.
I refer to that as authors whose names are now logos.
Yes, Like
Silverberg used to be that way as well.
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense, because that's what that cover feels like.
Yeah.
The other thing I actually just wanted to ask about briefly was actually about the short stories on Tor.com.
Mm-hmm.
What gave you the idea to actually start illustrating them?
That was right from the beginning. I mean, the idea of the site came from our Macmillan's executive vice president, Fritz Foy. And he just showed up at the Tor Christmas party and with mm-hmm. a bunch of magazines. And he was like, we can do this. We can publish short fiction and articles. And, it was Patrick Nielsen Hayden and I, and Teresa Nielsen Hayden, and Fritz. And because I was sitting there, I said, hey, we can have artwork. And they're like, yes, we can have artwork for everything. And so it was really right from the start. And I really kind of said, initially I said, oh, it would be a great place for me to try out younger artists and things, which is still definitely true. Although, as I say, I sort of realized not only that, but I can use artists that are more known for, their editorial work and things. Because just the nature of short fiction was so different than the nature of novels. And now we're expanding, we're expanding the whole program out. We're doing this novella program, which is actually novellas and short novels, and we're expanding that out into more commercial fiction, which we are selling, which we'll, we're not giving away for free on the site, but is meant to be also very sort of quick and nimble and be able to, publish things quickly and get things out, to readers quickly, and authors won't have to wait 2 years for their book to come out and everything. So it's been really fun. Our first books will publish in September, and we hired Lee Harris to be the senior editor on that. We have Carl Engelaird as the assistant editor, and both of them are just bringing in some tremendous titles. And It's funny. I had to hire an associate art director for that, and it was I knew this was going to be very tough because I'm like, no, I wound up with a very talented designer and a young designer, and I warned her many times. I'm like, I'm going to be very micromanaging until I get used to this, and she was actually very excited about the opportunity. So it's all seemed to we're creating this tiny little publishing company within Macmillan. And it's been really, really fun. And it's fun because I'm more in a publisher role with that. I get to, you know, the editors come and say, we like these titles, these stories, and what do you think? And I get to read them and sort of have opinions right from the start. And it's, Macmillan's great. It's, you know, it's a place that allows you to grow. They, you know, if they find that you're doing interesting things, they let you keep doing interesting things. Mm-hmm. So
that's nice.
Yeah.
It's nice.
Will we ever see a return of the embossed cover?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. So somebody like the other day was like, oh, we should emboss. And I'm like, oh my God, that's right. We emboss things. you know, to some degree, you know, it was funny. We did, we're doing Charlie Jane Ender's first novel. And I really loved the cover we came up with. But you know, the sales and marketing people say, well, what are the special effects on it? And I'm like, it actually sort of defies having any special effects. I'm like, you know, we're willing to put any money into what we want, but it's just doesn't want emboss or foil or anything like that. So which is not a value judgment about those things. It was just an interesting case of like trying to think of something to do. I'm like, you know what? It really is just best left alone. Mm-hmm. We're going to use a really nice paper stock and something, you know, but there's no sort of flash we can put on it. So yeah, there's still room for those sorts of things. But certainly less so in the day of like, not only, you know, it's regardless of people reading ebooks or paper books, their first encounter with these books is so often online, whether it's, you know, their friend Twitter, you know, putting a tweet up about it or going to Goodreads or whatever it is, you know, everybody's seeing these things so often just online rather than in bookstores. Mm.
Right.
Yeah, when we had David Annandale on, we were talking about the golden age of horror, and he was like, yeah, that's when every book had a die-cut cover. And I was like,
yeah.
I forgot die-cut covers.
You know, so actually with this Charlie Jane Anders one, we had a different cover that we didn't pick, and it would have had two birds that we could have die-cut out, but it's a risky thing because once they get damaged, people get upset. And yeah. You deal with lots of returns and so. But it was the first time I was like, ooh, die cut.
Well, that's interesting because has anyone really experimented with any form of effects for digital covers? There were some lenticular covers that I think DC Comics did a while ago.
Yeah, right.
They did an AB version that appeared on the e-copy.
It's hard because even if you know, people have done, like there was a Stephen King book where like the smoke kind of shimmied, and we actually even almost by mistake, we did a revolving cover for one of the Wheel of Time ebooks when we were doing new ebook covers for each book with different artists on each one, and it was a way to sort of engage with the readers throughout the long break between Jordan passing and Sanderson picking up the mantle with that. And we needed this massive battle sequence, and so Greg Manchez was like, I can't fit this into the square you've given me, and so he did this whole like really elongated composition, and we thought this was great because, you know, so much of this is just about engaging the fans that, you know, even if it doesn't all fit onto the book cover per se, we can still show it and talk about it, and people can get excited or not get excited. And and so we did actually make a version of the book cover that sort of rotated through, and everybody was like, oh my God, that's awesome. But ultimately you still can't put that onto Amazon, you still can't put that onto Barnes and Noble or iTunes or whatever. It's still just going to be, you know, one. And I'm a fan of still imagery. I always say people don't read books because there isn't enough TV to watch. And, you know, and same thing with artwork. You know, there's plenty of video games and movies and awesome things. But in the end, I like artwork. I like paintings. I go to museums. I like one narrative image that is compelling to me. And so whether or not everything in, you know, 20 years from now will all be animated and speaking to us, I don't know. But I kind of don't think so.
So who, and I'm not going to restrict this to live authors or live artists, who would be your dream artist to work with?
Well, that's a hard one.
Living or dead?
I'm going to say there's...
Or who are your favorites among historically?
Yeah, I was going to say Rosie O'Neill did this a series of, I think it was called Beautiful Monsters or something like that. Like these, you know, sort of fawn creature things. These like small, like men and these huge fawn creatures. And they are just so compelling to me. And I just think they're absolutely phenomenal. And I think there's a lot of contemporary artists that I think sort of harken back to that I really enjoy, Alan Williams being one of them. And there's an up and coming artist named Ravina Kai that also kind of has that aesthetic. And I think these are people that appeal to me very personally. Alan Williams did the cover for Queen Victoria. Why am I forgetting the second half of the title? But I'll get it out to you guys. But I think so. There's one example. I think Rosie O'Neill. And historically, who else? Jeez.
Anybody growing up, or
I grew up not even knowing it, but being a big fan of Leo and Diane Dillon. So they did plenty of children's picture books, but also, you know, when I first started reading science fiction. I remember there was a bunch of Harlan Ellison books with the cool covers. I didn't know who they were, but I wanted those covers. And they were, you know, at that point they were in used bookstores and reprints of things. But even I didn't even really like the idea of an illustrator wasn't really conscious in my mind, but I liked those covers. So the Dillons are definitely like favorites. A contemporary favorite that would be sort of a dream was Lisbeth Werger. Is an artist from Vienna and very, very well known there for doing a lot of storybooks and Wizard of Oz and things like that. And she's just, I think, one of the most brilliant artists we have today. There's a lot of dream people. And I love the people I'm working with. I really do. I just, you know, every time I have a new one for Chris Buzzelli or Sam Weber or any of these people, or, you know, Richard Anderson and... there's a new guy, Tommy Arnold, I'm working with, and it's just really exciting to see new people come into the field. And so it's all good.
Lately, I've noticed a few books that have included not extensive illustrations, but enough to make them noticeable. I was thinking... the Jack Vance tribute book that came out a few years ago,
right.
And Ship Star by Niven and Pornell, which had mostly technical diagrams and stuff like that.
Right.
But do you think we're going to see any more resurgence of Chapterillos or anything like that that come up?
I think, you know, they've... It's tough because it doesn't take an artist much less time to do a black and white image than it does to do a full on color image. The hard part is still the ideas, the composition, drawing it, you know. By the time you get to color, it's almost, you know, sort of you've done 75% of the work. So it's hard to get a budget where it really makes it worthwhile, for the artist to do if we pay them fairly. And how many more sales do you get out of it for that? On the other hand, it's never really gone away. I mean, for some, you know, we always seem to have something that we're doing. You know, actually, even the Dinosaur Lords, we were able to get about 10 chapter heads from Richard Anderson. And so we were able to commission those. And we did some Gene Wolfe books a while back where we commissioned chapter heads. So it's always kind of been around. And actually, Brandon Sanderson believes very strongly in such things, and it's nice because he's got, you know, there's enough oomph behind him that it is worth, you know, the budget and the time and everything else that it takes to do it. So certainly the Stormlight Archives are sort of, you know, heavily illustrated, and he's doing, you know, we're reissuing some of his middle grade books with all the new illustrations. And so I can only hope that, you know, the more Sandersons that are out there, maybe the more we'll get to do that sort of thing. Again, I think with Tor.com, you know, we can sometimes get away with things like that. We did a Mary Rickert novella The Mothers of Voorsville, and just basically on sheer fact that I loved it to death, and so did the cover artist. We were able to squeeze out a little extra money and do a couple of drawings throughout it, and that was a lot of fun. So it doesn't go away. It's always around, but whether or not we'll get back to like those NCY, it's beautiful books with lots of illustrations, color illustrations, I don't know. Although, you know, I say that, and there's something called the Folio Society in London, and that's what they do. They do classics and modern classics as well, and they hire artists, and they just did a 50th anniversary edition of Dune with with Sam Weber, and that just went everywhere. Everybody went nuts for that. But they've done Douglas Adams, they've done a lot of Philip K. Dick, so they do, you know, quite a bit of that as a specialty, and they're beautiful, beautiful editions.
I wanted to wrap it up, or at least this part, with a talk about how you're paying things forward, and that would be the illustration masterclass.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, if I was going to ask if you could describe what that's all about.
Usually, you know, when I talk to people that know writing things, I say it's kind of like a clarion for artists. It's shorter. It's only 1 week, but it is a hyper-intensive workshop. Now, it's about 100 students and anywhere from 9 to 15, really, instructors, depending on the day. It's class time from about 10 in the morning till 10 at night. There's lectures. There's studio time. There's demos. We give an assignment. This is all was conceived of and run by Rebecca Gay, who's just phenomenal. And she asked me for a few assignments for the illustration part of it. Sometimes there's a comics component. This year there's a gallery component. So there's a couple people sort of, you know, adding to the assignments based on their specialty. But so we gave them, we gave all this, the upcoming students, and by students, I mean, it's first come, first serve, first 90 people that sign up. So you've got everything from pros to actual, you know, college age people to people that have retired and decided they want to learn how to paint, which is amazing because at that point, like all the ego just comes out of it. There's no point in trying to be best in class. Like the whole point of it is to just make everybody just a tiny bit better. And that's what's amazing about it, is that it's really just takes every student and just says, whatever your abilities are, we just want to be able to push them forward a little bit and give everyone the same amount of respect, whether or not they are pro or not. And so, yes, we give assignments, and many of them are our actual book covers. And I'm giving them pretty much what they, you know, what the cover artist got, so that it's a very realistic sort of assignment. Others are more classics and, you know, reinvent Alice in Wonderland as, you know, as a noir fantasy or something. You know, we'll play with those sort of things too, just so that everybody's trying to give enough assignments that everybody's doing something in the genre that they want to do. And so first day of class, everybody shows up with their thumbnails, and this is as if I was getting an email with all these thumbnails, and it's like a 12-hour wall crit where all the instructors just go through these thumbnails and just like in very kind and supportive ways, just rip them apart and put them back together. And all these students sort of come out of it very shell-shocked, and there's so little time, so they just start grabbing their, you know, the guy next to them and start redoing their reference and helping each other out. And hopefully they get to painting by day 2 or 3, and hopefully by day 7 they've got a near-to-finished illustration. And most people do, and many people have, you know, the piece of their life coming out of it. It's really just a and I really credit all of it to Rebecca, just because she just has such a good heart about it, and it's just put together such a good tight program. And it's, you know, when I say all these instructors, it's Donato Giacolo, Dan DeSantos, Boris Vallejo, Julie Bell, Jim Gurney, just goes on. Scott Fisher. It's really like the top of the field, and that's just the core. We have Ian McKay, who designed Darth Maul from Star Wars. He's there every year. You know, it's Mike Mignola, who did who writes and draws Hellboy. You know, he's there every year. It's just a phenomenal week.
Wow.
Yeah.
People get very evangelical when they start talking about IMC. So I apologize.
No. That's pretty amazing. I mean, great that like I said, I like how you're paying back or paying it forward. Or
yeah, well, I mean, I'm a paid instructor, and so I always feel, when somebody says, oh, they were thinking about, you know, going to IMC, should they do it? I always start with saying, like, listen, I'm a paid instructor, so I'm totally, you know, but it really is the best thing ever, and it's at Amherst College, and you know, it's beautiful, beautiful campus, yeah, and the downtown is gorgeous, and. And, you know, it's this beautiful setting, not that you're outside of the studios much, but it is nice just to walk over to the, you know, the cafeteria and just be in this very idyllic, especially as somebody who went to school in Manhattan. I'm like, oh, real school. It has a lawn.
I used to live in Western Mass, so I used to go up there quite a bit. And I always loved the, Kevin Anderson's Global Dispatches, The War of the Worlds anthology he did. I think the Connie Willis story took place on the green in Amherst.
Oh, there you go.
Emily Dickinson watching the tripods come down.
Yeah. The B&B I stay at is right across the street from her house. So, yeah, it's beautiful.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Any more art questions, gentlemen, or shall we move on to culture consumed?
I'm good. That's more than enough. Now I got to get my...
John, would you like to start
this time? Sure. Because I actually consumed some culture this time around. I finished several books, although I'm sure I didn't finish as many as Fred did. I just finished reading Paolo Bacigalupi's new novel, The Water Knife, for review. And I'm going to write a review of that for SF Signal pretty soon. And that was... It was a very... I hate the adjective interesting because it's a terrible adjective, but it was very interesting. It's good. The book is good. It's very well written. He's a very strong writer. He can really concisely make a point. He can really concisely show you a character. But you get a real lived in feel for the worlds that he's creating in his fiction. From his short fiction to bigger stuff like this. So you get a really keen sense of what's going on very quickly. Basically, it's a story about resource depletion, water, in the American West, and these basically water wars that are being fought. And there are a couple of different POV characters, and one of them is the aforementioned Water Knife, who is a paid sort of operative of one of the biggest water hoarders in the American West. And the novel follows him and a few other people as they struggle to, it's going to sound weird, find the oldest, you know, most senior water rights in the West and sell them to the highest bidder. That sounds really not very interesting, but he does a very good job of making the topic interesting, mostly because he tries to show you people's lives from several different angles. So you see how the sort of wealthy are living, how the downtrodden are living, and... my only two complaints are, this is one of the things I find about his work, that he tends to hyper-accentuate how bad things will get. It's like the idea that in maybe a generation or two, America will descend into a nation of feuding states with almost no central government. Maybe it can happen, but it doesn't seem that believable. But that's a central conceit he needs to make the story work, to have states feuding for water with each other. But what he talks about in terms of the environmental problems really hits home. Like I said, he does a very good job of making you feel what's going on. And I thought the ending was great. It was actually a surprise. I was all ready for it to end one way, and it totally ended a different way. But I kind of feel that a couple of the relationships he builds in the novel don't quite gel. They don't really seem they're more convenient for him than they are sort of organic in the story. But like I said, I thought it was a pretty good read. It's a pretty good book, and I'll have a review of that hopefully in a week or two up on SF Signal. I also finished David Seed's Ray Bradbury Modern Masters of Science Fiction book.
Yay!
Which I mentioned last time as not being very impressed with. And that impression held toward the end. But it's better than over half the books so far in the series.
But not as good as Karen's.
But not no. Karen still has the prize with her Greg Egan book, and again, like I said, because that book makes me want to go read Greg Egan, none of these other books make me go like, oh, I really gonna want to go read that author now. And Seed's problem is I feel like he dances around some of the complexities of Bradbury's work to make generalizations and make particular literary points that he wants to make. So I don't feel we're getting sort of a really large, like a sort of a general view of Bradbury's work that then focuses in. I just feel like he picks things out here and there. And I wanted more, you know, what were the trends? Because I've now read the first two volumes of Bradbury's biography too. So I know a lot more about Bradbury's life and work. And I don't see this book jibing with what I know about Bradbury's life and his creative life at different periods. So it just falls kind of short. Like maybe someone who hasn't done that much reading on Bradbury's life will get more out of it than I did. But I didn't feel I learned a lot from it. And what I want from these kind of books from prestigious university presses is to learn a lot. I want to be enlightened. Tell me things I might not have seen in the stories or in the author's life, you know? I also just finished, because I tore through it, Sisters of the Revolution, Anne and Jeff Vandermeer's new anthology, which is a feminist speculative fiction anthology from PM Press. That was fan-freaking-tastic. I wasn't sure what to expect, because it's a very broad, like, there's no topic. It's feminist speculative fiction. And it goes back, you know, several decades to just sort of the present day. So I wasn't sure what to expect because, you know, how are they going to define feminism? What kind of feminisms are they focusing on? How does that influence the story choice? And also their introduction is maddeningly brief. So you don't get much more of a clue from there. But once you've read the volume, you start to see what they found. They just found these really great stories that are focused on women as strong characters and as motivators of story. That's really what it boils down to. These are great stories that happen to have women as sort of not just the main protagonists, but what they do and how the world unfolds and what's going on directly impacts women and the characters in a way that really illuminates notions of how gender works, how we culturally construct gender, and things like that. So I thought it was really a smashing book. I don't say that very often.
No, you don't.
I don't. And then the last book that I read was Shunryu Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which I've read before.
Ooh.
But my mentor at university died a couple months ago of cancer, unfortunately. And he actually, shortly after I left university, he retired and became a Zen priest under Suzuki Roshi. So I felt like I wanted to go back and reread this book, which I had read a long time ago when I was interested in Buddhism, sort of as a memorial to my mentor, but also because it just put me in mind of, you know, I've been looking for writing and for art recently that sort of puts me back in a more relaxed, less critical frame of mind, just kind of pulls me back a little bit from things. And this was a very good book for that, because while it's about Zazen, about Zen meditation practice, it's really about how to adjust your perspective on life so you don't drive yourself or others crazy. That's what I've always taken away from the book, is that, you know, if you just step back from your ideas of yourself in different modes, just take a step back from that and look at the world with a slightly, you know, less ferocious sort of consumptive perspective, you will learn a lot more about life.
Yeah.
And that's what I've always taken away from it. So that was really nice to read too. And then I didn't read a lot of comics this month, but I did read Dan Slott and Mike and Laura Allred's run on Silver Surfer up to issue 11, which I think ends the current storyline.
Yeah.
And again, that was fan-freaking-tastic.
Yeah, that was
Well, first of all, I love Mike Allred anyway. I've been reading him since he first started doing Madman. Been a fan of his for decades now, I guess. And I had heard this was sort of a fun, quirky read. So I was expecting some kind of Madman-ish kind of thing, but it's not at all.
No.
The artwork is classic Allred. It's got the vibrant colors. It's got the trippy panel layouts. It's got the almost like melt, like the art is just so fluid. And he just, I don't know how he comes up with faces and gestures and expressions, but he just has this limitless supply of faces and just has this amazing palette that is crazy and should not work, but always seems to work. And that art combined with this sort of cosmic story of how the Silver Surfer essentially has to save people whose planets he's led Galactus to devour, yeah. could be a really stupid storyline, but Dan Slott really manages to make it a very significant. I mean, it's fun, and it's kind of light in places. It doesn't get too heavy, but at the same time, I really thought it kept my attention more than, say, just some kind of humorous riff on the Silver Surfer would. There was a lot of decent characterization, and you actually, I feel, kind of learned something more about the character they're building for their version of the Silver Surfer throughout the run. And that really kept my attention reading the book. So, and it's just art and writing really meshed very strongly. So that was just a pure pleasure to read. And that's my... Oh, and I'm also reading for the Hugos, and that's mostly sucking.
no comment.
I finished the novel. I read all the novelettes. I decided to start in the middle of the short fiction section, and I'm really scared to go on to the other two short fiction categories. But I'm going to read Three Body Problem first. Let's take a break from the short fiction categories
Palette
and read...
Cleanser.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So read sort of a palate cleanser before I dive back into the relatively, I don't know, unimpressive categories. I mean, the novelettes were even the best novelette, Thomas Olva Hewitt's story. It was okay. I didn't love it. It wasn't fabulous, but it was okay, and it was something I haven't seen very often before. Taking sort of an end of the world tale and sort of grafting it onto sort of a broken heart story. I thought the story was pretty good. It just didn't like maybe go yay. It was just like, oh, that was good. Yeah. Nice. But everything else just bad. Just not. Well, the thing that actually bothered me the most, and this always bothers me, is that two stories out of professional magazines were terribly edited. Like down to the level of like missing prepositions and sentences. And I'm like, how does that happen? How do the editors, this is you're submitting to the Hugos, these stories that are published in your magazines, and they're just full of errors. Like right there, and it didn't help, the stories weren't very good. But, so it's the Hugo stuff's been pretty aggravating so far. I'm not super impressed. I'm hoping to like, the Three Body Problem. I've heard great things about it, so like you said, I'm sort of taking it as a palate cleanser before I dive back into the short fiction morass.
The short fiction morass.
Yes.
Oh, Irene, do you actually have time to read for pleasure, or?
No, I've become one of these terrible poets, especially now with the novella program. I am a slow reader to begin with, and I've become one of these terrible people that's... only reads for work. So, but my exciting thing was, I guess it wasn't this past week, but we got a Sean McGuire story for Every Heart a Doorway, which we released the cover for, and I really enjoyed that, and I'm hoping people respond to that. So, I'll throw that out there.
Okay. Well, Jeff, you or
yeah,
or me?
I this week was a little bittersweet for me because literally the day after we recorded our last episode, I started reading the Tanith Lee collection, Space is Just a Starry Night, which I had never read. It actually had two new stories in it when it came out a couple of years ago. And most of the stories that are in there are from the 80s. There is some 90s and some 2000 stuff. But like Written in Water and Tonight I Can Sleep Quietly and Stalking the Leopard and stuff like that. But it also had Within the Ghost, which is a story I'd never read before, which I really, really liked. And I sort of read it in a day after we did our last thing. So, yeah, this week has been a bit upsetting for me regarding that. It didn't help that immediately after that, I started reading The Scarlet Gospels by Clive Barker, which is everything I want from it. It is just incredibly gory. but I'm a huge Barkerverse fan, and especially given the really good comics that have come out under the banner, I was in exactly the mood for that book as I started reading it. On my last trip down to South Carolina, I actually caught up with story podcasts because I hadn't been doing a lot of short fiction lately. A couple of things that really stood out for me. On Pseudopod, they had a Thomas Ligotta story called Drink to Me Only with Labyrinthine Eyes, which I had never read, which was really good, about a parlor magician who does some very naughty things to a party he's attending. There was in Clark's world, there was an Andrea Pauly story called For the Love of Sylvia City about people who are augmented to live underwater, who are dealing with a communications cable that leads to a city that a lot of people went to after something called the Carbon Wars kind of scorched the surface world. Really good, really nice bit of claustrophobic, you know, people that are entombed in these suits to swim around, and that was really good. Two stories that I really liked. Matthew Kressel, The Garden Beyond Her Infinite Skies, was so good. I really want this expanded into a Star Maker style novel, but I doubt we'll get that. But it was a really good story. Emily Davenport did Postcards from Monster Island, which I also liked, which is about some people that decide to stay on New York after a number of kaiju start rolling up onto the shore and start a blog about it. It was pretty funny. That story I like that story. So. Lightspeed had one I really liked, The Universe Sung in Stars by Cat Howard, which was a very heavily stylized piece about people that craft artificial galaxies that become part of one's wardrobe and personal scape of technology that they have draped around them. Really good about the people that they're sort of the artificers who build this stuff. It was really, really good. Two comics I want to mention. Number one, the first issue of Injection by Warren Ellis and Declan Shavley came out. And I'm really intrigued because he's sort of leaning into... He's hinting at something a little bit Lovecraftian there, and I'm curious where he's going to go. Should also mention this week the first issue of Providence by Alan Moore came out, which is where he's going to prove to us that we're all way too comfortable with H.P. Lovecraft and his mythos. I have yet to read it, but I am looking forward to it. However, I am a little nervous because the last miniseries that he did in his Lovecraft cycle was very disturbing indeed. So, and lastly, I want to talk about... Sword of Sorrows, which is the crossover that Gail Simone is doing with Sergio Davila, of all of the various female characters, Red Sonja and Vampirella, and I think Sheena the Jungle Girl is in there, and several others. And she's doing this kind of almost a classic Crisis on Infinite Earth crossover, jumping between worlds and universes and time frames, and it all has to do with a number of swords that all of these characters carry with them and how they all sort of impact one another. It's not often that I say a comic is weird, but this comic was weird. Weird enough that I'm intrigued as to where it's going to go next, because I put my trust in Gail Simone implicitly in almost all things. So I will be following this along. As with all crossovers, apparently there are several tie-in books that will be involved as well. And, whether or not they will keep up the weirdness, we'll have to see. That's all I got.
All right. Well, I have been reading for the Nebulas. Not that I'm going to vote, but because I'll be on a competing podcast. And I really enjoyed Catherine or is it Catherine? I'm not sure. Catherine Addison's The Goblin Emperor, which was completely not what I expected it to be as far as a fantasy novel, so I highly recommend that. I got an advanced reading copy of The Nemesis Games by James S.A. Corey, the latest Expanse book, and I'm looking forward even more than I was previously to see what the television series does with that. Charles Gannon, Kane Riordan number 2, Fire with Fire. I just finished that. That was a lot of fun. In nonfiction, I'm trying to read nonfiction this year, but I kind of got sidetracked by the fact that I'm now doing reviews for the SF Book Club. But I did finish a book called Eating Vietnam by Graham Holiday. And if anybody is on Twitter, I know we all are, look for a guy named Noodle Pie. And he often posts pictures from Vietnam, and that will leave you very hungry, all those pictures. It's a great book about travel. And I recommend books like this for science fiction writers because it's a great way of learning about how to depict another culture. And speaking of the Science Fiction Book Club and a name that Irene mentioned, I read for them 4 volumes of the Plague of Frogs arc for the Hellboy spinoff series called it's the Bureau of, I'm looking for the name because I can never remember it, the Bureau for Paranormal Research and Defense. And this series takes several characters from Hellboy and gives them their own title. And this particular arc is about a Lovecraftian outbreak of creatures, frogs, Hyperboreans, really big nasty guys, and all sorts of stuff. The main characters are things like a Homunculus, a woman who's a fire starter, a spirit who was caught out of his body when his body was killed, so they keep him in a spacesuit. And a guy, Abe Sapien, who's was found in a hibernation tube in Washington, D.C., and basically lives underwater. And, I mean, if you want to think of like a combination of the X-Files and maybe something like Glenn Cook's Garrett P.I. or the Dresden Files by mm-hmm. Jim Butcher, but with much bigger, nastier creatures and lovely artwork, subdued colors. It's not garish. It definitely has like an autumn feel for me. And I tore through each one in a night. So those are great. And look for my reviews on the SF Book Club website. And then I went retro one day and reread The Weapon Shops of Ishtar by A.E. Van Vogt. Just because I wanted atomic energy and blasters and time travel and a plot that changes direction every 800 words the way Van Vogt always did and all sorts of other stuff and scheming empresses. And so I may read the sequel real soon, you know, on another nice day. I blame fellow SF Signal and author Jamie Todd Rubin, who got me started rereading the Asimov autobiography. And then one day I was sitting outside. I'm like, I don't feel like Asimov. I want to read Golden Age. And that's what I picked up. So that's my list.
Yeah, I just started rereading the Frederick Pohl autobiography.
Oh, yes.
Individual chapters, just going through it and remembering my own formative teen years in fandom and going, my God, I had it so good compared to those guys. So.
Well, Irene, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show tonight.
Thank you.
Not only because we've kind of known each other for years now, and and I keep walking by the Flatiron Building saying I really ought to visit, but I don't want to bother people during the day, you know.
Oh, just come on up. We'll take any excuse to avoid some work. Okay. 14th floor.
Yep. All right. And, gentlemen, I'll see you online, and we will be back next month with another very special Fourth Horseman, which may be even more controversial than Irene's statement about tearing clothes up.
Oy, I'm in trouble now. Well, thanks, guys. This was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.